attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by the prospective parliamentary candidate for Calder Valley for the Liberal Democrats, Javed Bashir. Welcome to the podcast, Javed.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. So to begin with, I'd like to ask. The Liberal Democrats have quite a bit of a fight on their hands in Calder Valley. Are you optimistic about the election campaign?
Absolutely. We are, you know, without a doubt, the underdogs in this coming up campaign. But we've got probably one of the most biggest upswings in terms of population, the population backing us in terms of what our position is and where we stand on certain key policies and our position in the world and on the Brexit topic, especially if you look at the last national poll, which was a European election, that we came above Labour and above the Conservatives. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at the massive surge in local elections prior to that, you know, we've had the highest number of local elected councillors in our history. Our membership is going up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the previous polls of the last elections is in no way a reflective view of what's going on or what's happened or what's changed. Mm-hmm. So absolutely optimistic.
Now, in the constituency, the Greens have recently announced that they will be standing aside in favour of Green voters voting for the Labour candidate. Do you think that that is something that will make this much more of a difficult fight? Was it ever anything that... I don't know what the situation is with the local parties, but was this ever considered as a possibility? I mean...
Just to give you the context of what happened in that conversation there. So I actually had a personal conversation with the chair of the of the Green Party in Calderdale. Mm-hmm. He's a well-known personality within the sort of political landscape because of his green credentials. And my conversation was on the lines of to give us the update of what they were doing, that they were going to build a pact or agree a pact with the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. And we wished them well. I personally wished him well. The decision was theirs. Personally, I think that it's a good thing that they're doing, because the Labour's climate change policy is weak. Mm. And the Liberal Democrats is light years ahead in terms of what they want to do and how they're going to achieve this. And that's a key difference between us and all the other parties. Other parties make promises saying we'll do this, or we'll promise to work hard on this. And my view on it is that everybody works hard and everything they do, right? But we've got practical, on the ground, hands-on delivery, deliverable solutions that can be costed. So it was a welcome, view that, they've actually done that. But the politics of it behind was that they did ask us if we wanted to sign a pact with them on the same topic, the Liberal Democrats. It was turned down, and including the last election as well. And that's partly because of the numbers. In recent months, Extinction Rebellion's taken the wind out of the Green Party, so they are losing quite a lot of support to that movement. And on top of that, their last election turnout was 600, right? So there was a huge risk that they might lose their deposits this time round, as you can see in other parts of the country, that the Green parties are signing up pacts with others simply because it's a cost-benefit thing there. Is £500 worth of deposit worth 500 votes or 600, or could they lend their support base, which there is one, to somebody else that there? But the critical part for me and the party probably was the fact that they want to go with a people's vote option after an election. Mm. And it's a retrospect for us that we, our position is clear. We're the Remain and Revoke party, not the Remain and people's vote. If there is a people's vote, we'll support Remain. Mm. But right now, our option for the country and our residents and the constituencies are... to revoke and remain. So that would have been a step backwards for us. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that in this particular part of the country that you're standing in, that one of the major topics has been opposition to fracking, and recently the government have put in a temporary halt to fracking. Is this something that you would hope can be permanently banned? Do you think that this was something that a Liberal Democrat government, or at least the Liberal Democrats involved in government, would put as a priority?
If the Liberal Democrats were in majority government, the conversation would probably continue as it is, simply because it's one of those areas that we just don't know enough.
Mm-hmm.
So there were reports, there's evidence, there's been geological surveys, there's been some other, you know, conversations, you know, with all different stakeholders across the board, right, about exactly what impact this has, and the conspiracy theories around that it's a fracking, fossil fuel industry that's against this, or mm-hmm. they're against the renewable energies. So there's a lot of misinformation that's out there at the moment. And, you know, within a government, you have to be responsible and not to dismiss things out of hand simply because they're, not popular. That's just the reality of it. So at the moment, the way it stands, it's open for discussion and debate, trying to figure out exactly where we move on from here. Is fracking good? My personal view on it, it's not, mm-hmm. because there are some benefits that come out of fracking, but there is a huge amount of other alternative renewable energy sources that can be used.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be a decision by whoever actually sort of takes up government
mm-hmm.
positions in that area.
Now, I know that earlier this year you were standing in Elland for the to be a councillor for Elland in
yes.
In West Yorkshire, and one of the major thrusts of your campaign was ensuring greater sense of digital connectivity for the area, and you know, improving digital technology in the area. Is this something that you think would be, if you were elected as the Member of Parliament for Calder, that you would pursue as an MP, whether in government or in opposition?
As a resident, I'd pursue this option because it's mm-hmm. the right thing to do. So it's not whether I'm standing for public office or not. When I was a local candidate, because my political career literally started, 8-9 months ago when I was asked to stand for the Liberal Democrats in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
I had something close to 34, 35 days from the point when I got the approval, was parachuted in, and then had to run a campaign and do the polling there. Mm-hmm. As a first timer, I lost, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Participation is just as important. And one of the key things that I found from having worked in industry for 20 plus years is that, you know, digital, you know, the economic paradigms of how we work, manufacturing, food production, drinks, bioscience, whichever industry or sector you're in, it is all being digitized.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the underlying issues was and is still the connectivity side of it. So I went around knocking on doors, knocking on shops, speaking to the business owners, and I find that, you know, there are still some businesses still using dial-up.
And
they've got websites to run. It's a retail shop. So, you know, he's always been complaining about the fact that he's never had a good dial-up internet connection. So, you know, it became, you know, the main thrust of, well, one of the main pillars of what's out there. Now, internet, I come from a technical background. So, mm-hmm. you know, I worked for telecoms companies for many, many years. Are the, you know, top end of R&D development to, you know, just frontline services, you know, phone calls, customer service. So I understand mm-hmm. the challenges and implications of that. And then when you look at the environment in terms of the, the diminishing high streets,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like ghost towns and whatnot. One of the thrusts behind my view on this was that, okay, what is going to attract more people to come in to the town and stay in town?
Mm.
If there's free internet, why wouldn't people want to come in? When you've got children or kids from school walking past, rather than hanging around on the streets with nothing, the whole gaming industry can be created. I mean, I know businesses that are creating immersive tech pods. So if you've got free internet access, you know, that's going to keep them out of trouble, you know, get them to do something,
mm-hmm.
Create some more economic viability of, you know, of the rationale behind why people and the footfall needs to be maintained. So that was just, you know, a number of areas. And on top of that, I've worked in a e-healthcare project across the continent of Europe in terms of the aging society and mm-hmm. the bringing the services or the diagnostics and health treatments closer to the home, rather than having to get, you know, patients to travel all the way to the hospitals. Internet connectivity was a fundamental, you know, underlying utility type of service for them. So that my view again was that, you know, why can't we just sort of offer free internet services for all the health related medicines and treatments, and then itemize billing some other way. So there are commercial models that are available there. So that is what I will continue on doing. And I've had conversations with the council and the Economic Regeneration Directorship at the council. So whether I get elected into public office or not, and that will carry on because it's just the right thing to do. It's just a natural progression. Because the high streets are never going to be the way they are, they used to be. It has to evolve into something different, something unique or niche that can replace it.
Do you think that the lack of access to technology and the decline of the high street is one of the things that has driven the desire to leave the European Union as one of the driving forces behind Brexit?
Not in itself. I think, I mean, it depends on how you view that that question. That has technology driven people away from the high streets? Yes, it has. If you look at the context of the new internet business models, mm-hmm. Amazon, eBay, Airbnb, you know, everything is literally online. There's nothing to do with pen and paper when you can automate and process everything remotely. And when you change billing structures and a whole raft of other things, you know, this type of fundamental change takes place. You can, for example, you know, buy something online, you know, and return it for free yeah. if you don't like it at the comfort of your home. That is a fundamental shift. So, you know, buying behaviours and consumerism, it's all changed as it is there. So then the high streets aren't sustainable. And fundamentally to that, it's the actual, the business rates model that they are paying, you know, twice as much rates as internet businesses. So there's no cost saving incentives there. So that's another point I'm keen on sort of developing if I do get into office to, you know, have a like a land tax based model or something to that effect. But then at the same time, the internet has created this environment where, you know, conversations, social media and the monetization of clickbaiting and whatnot that has made it easy for incentivizing nefarious players in that sector to sort of, you know, take advantage of. So it's a whole raft of things like that, why people have actually chosen to go, you know, with the Brexit route. You know, we've never been in this situation where we've had the campaigning ability to actually sort of influence people's opinions, views, in such a mass way. So I, again, you know, from a techie side of view, so when you look at big data, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and all these, put them all together, you know, the three things that you know, defines big data is volume, veracity, and variety of data that's coming through at you. You just cannot cope with it. And then you're just inundated with messages, right? So it's like paralysis by analysis, and they just, you know, beat you into submission and accepting what's been said to you. And these are the things that are still going on even till now. So tech is a good thing because it actually does help improve lives, standards of living, you know, creates wealth and all the rest of all that. But then it can also be weaponized as well, which is where we have to be careful. And I think that's the symptoms we're suffering right now, in part for that.
The Liberal Democrat manifesto has not been released yet, but of the manifesto, what do you hope would be the focus on in terms of policies and the general theme of the manifesto?
From my take from the 2017 manifesto, it has to be revolving around local economies and localisation. So when we were in the coalition, we promoted the Localism Act, you know, quite significantly, to the point we actually got it passed through the bill as a concession to other things that we had an option to. But then that has created the ability for local councils, research organisations and other bodies that were created on the back of that to give the local community the powers to make decisions locally. So it's at a small scale at the moment. For example, you know, the business improvement districts where any community organisation can get together, business community can get together and create like a preset to actually raise finances themselves. The councils will be responsible for raising the money and then allocating it back. And then those businesses can actually then spend that money in their local area, do the improvements. So it doesn't have to go through the usual sort of public procurement panel, or even the local councils, the councillors, you know, cabinet meetings and approvals process. It's just direct. They're just, you know, addressing their own issues there. So this is where the disconnect happens, that the council have got priority. They've got funding cuts so big they have to decide which ones are their high priorities. And likewise, you know, and then they have the consultations, which is a legal requirement. And then once they've done the legal consultation, usually like those views of the people, their voices aren't either taken into account or they're contradictory to what the actual policy is or how the procedures have got to be sort of, you know, put forward or passed. You know, but a bid, for example, is that, you know, there's the money, there's your priority, go and spend the money. Those are the sort of areas that I think need to happen. And that's within our manifesto about giving people control and power at the local level. So one of the big areas of focus or the central pillars is the Yorkshire devolution deal, which, you know, I'm behind 100% because with the Yorkshire devolution deal, there is an expected 200,000 new jobs that are going to be created in this region, you know, adding like something close to 112 billion in the GDP for the local economy and, you know, being a net contributor to the public purse and all the whole raft of other things there. So we're fragmented at the moment with four different geographies, that all becoming one and simple. You know, this is equivalent of, you know, an extra £500 in one of the reports that came out per person within the boundary. But then we've got control over our investment for buses, for trains, for local services, for education. So we actually can make our decision based on our local priorities rather than making a case individually to the central government and asking them, you need money for this, can we have it? And they'll say, no, you need to do something else before you can do this. So those are the priorities that, you know, that we have there. And that's all within the Lib Dems manifesto as it stands.
You mentioned there, obviously, a greater ability for councils in the north to be able to make decisions for themselves. How do you view projects like the Northern Powerhouse and HS2, which in their own way have proved somewhat controversial?
I completely agree that there is a lot of controversy in terms of very strong and passionate and emotive views against them. So the HS2 has been suspended pending a review since Boris Johnson came into number 10. Now, there are many critics of this, and some are environmental, some are more noise pollution sort of oriented, others are emissions and net zero carbon footprint situations where, you know, where they can't actually find the benefits for that, and others it's a cost, it's massively overrun and over cost. Now what people need to realize is that this railway network is not, or this, you know, the HS2 is not for 10 years 15 years. This is has at least a minimum of 200 years of life cycle in terms of how it's going to be delivered there. We're maxed out in our capacity. I used to work in London and down in Worthing and a few other places down south from where I am here. And I used to have to stand in the train carriage, walking, you know, all the way down there. There wasn't even enough room to actually sit because you need, you know, the full space of two people there. So, you know, you cannot increase the carriages without affecting the train lines, and you can't, you know, you double up the train carriages because of the traffic and congestion on there. So there's a whole raft of different reasons why we do need, you know, a much more faster net, well, not necessarily a faster one, but a bigger network or a different network to actually then connect the rest of the part of the country. Now, there is an argument that some say that, you know, this is all beneficial for the south and southeast and not for the north, but and that we should be focusing more on HS3, which is the coast-to-coast from Liverpool to Hull. Fine, I agree with that, but then you have to start from somewhere. So where we've invested billions already within the plans and infrastructure designs and whatnot there, and they're only, so, you know, a third way through, you have to then start again from scratch. And for that, you have to then so go back to central government and the Treasury and ask them, we want this money for this. How are you going to sort of quantify all the money that's already been spent on the designs? So irrespective of whatever the views are, Leeds, for example, where the station is going to be rebuilt, is going to be the central hub for this, which then connects it up into Manchester, then into Newcastle. And the HS3 will connect through that there. So the way I see it is that's not money wasted per se. It's a case of it's a stepping stone to actually where we need to get to. Northern Powerhouse is contributing towards this, and it's all about the regional rebalancing of the economy. And that nicely fits into my overall sort of view what I had earlier about Yorkshire devolution, because all of these things are leading to that one scenario where we take control local. I completely accept there are people out there that have completely contradictory, or not contradictory, but completely opposing views on the various grounds there. But not doing it is not good enough, because if we don't, then, you know, the rebalancing of the economy will just not happen. It's as simple as that. Because the amount of people that are travelling in and out of the central countries there. And even if you look at the house prices, for example, people are travelling more up north to buy houses out of London because of the extortionate rates of one-bedroom apartments and flats that are, you know, say at six, seven, you know, figure sums. So there's a whole, you know, raft of other reasons why that is there. Projects like this, they're not small, they're not overnight projects, and you know, and then we only realize the benefits, you know, in long term. And it's even with the Channel Tunnel, when we connected Dover to Calais, people, you know, were making cases that it's a waste of money, it can't be done, it shouldn't be done. But the economic benefits of that, even though it was a loss making project for many years, from launch, it still is a new channel that was opened between the two. So it, you know, there is always risks involved. But that's what the point of government is, and these are always ongoing projects. So they're you know, living projects. They're not a case of that once we've drawn a schematic for the designs of, you know, station A to station B, for example, it's not going to change because reality changes. They just adapt.
Now, one of and this hasn't really been a part of the political scene for a while, but one of the major arguments in terms of sort of like devolution was the idea of an English Parliament in the same way that there is a Scottish Parliament and a Welsh Assembly. What would your thoughts on that be? Do you think that would be a positive thing in terms of devolution, or do you think it would be something that wouldn't work?
My personal view on it is it wouldn't work. Although others might want to take advantage of that. But at the same time, there is a case to be made. Just like all the other devolution deals you have in the Greater Manchester, in the Midlands, and even in Sheffield, you know, there is a case that we need to have decisions made locally, and the priority has to be local there. I'm not in favour of creating any type of borders or any friction between the United Kingdom in any way, shape or form.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for being on, Chafford. It's been a great discussion, a very interesting discussion.
Okay.
I'd just like to ask you one final question. One of the major points of contention between some of the other parties and the Liberal Democrats have been the now infamous Liberal Democrat bar charts, which show the Liberal Democrats more likely to win here than other parties and all that sort of thing. What do you think of them?
Usually we have a very robust way of determining what data we actually publish. We have a very robust process in terms of the due diligence we take here when we're acquiring information. Everything's in the public domain. Everything's there for checking and whatnot there. I am not saying categorically that there aren't issues. There might be, because, you know, there are situations there where you actually then rely on some third party that where you get the data from. So we go by, you know, by faith in what we supplied, but we do tend to actually sort of give as much, you know, audit everything that we submit. So if you find a bar chart that is completely skewed in a different direction, you know, I would first of all say, okay, look at the context and have a conversation about what do you mean by this, rather than just dismissing it offhand as fake news or, you know, misinformation, because sometimes the context and the data could be used in a way that it wasn't intended in the first place, but you then find out the new realities have emerged in hindsight, you know, whether it's hindsight biased or whether it's just new, you know, new lights of how you view things. You know, so you can frame a question in a way to get a specific answer. And it's the same thing, you can frame an answer to get a specific type of view to, that needs to be promoted. So if the bar charts are skewed and the numbers from the Electoral Commission, for example, that has to publish all these, is completely off track. Flag it with the person that did that in the first instance, because there could be reason.
Yeah.
If you accept it, and if you don't accept it, you know, that's a, you know, that's an individual, you know, judgment call there. So I won't promote misinformation or fake news, you know, in any way, shape or form or wherever it comes from. But we do have a robust process in terms of validating all the information we put out into the public domain.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. It's been a delight to have you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean or YouTube. You can follow us at Debated Podcast on Twitter.
like us, Debated Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to email us, either about appearing or making a comment or reaction to the episode you've heard, or any other episodes, then email us, thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.